Hey, it's Prophecy Sun. When I'm not riding my bike, hanging out with my cats, or making soup, I'm listening to Tweets and Tunes on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
It's the best of Radio Free Thinker of 2014, the best segments of the last year. This time, free trade, now and then. The Iraqi Dilemma and Globalized Ethics, and Sharkumentary, the Decline of Science Documentaries. So let's begin this very special Best of 2014 Radio Freethinker.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about responsibility to protect. Much of the world has been stunned by the current civil war in Iraq. Okay, most have yet to call it that, but that's what it is. You have the Sunnis on the one side who are attempting to regain some status in the nation that they formerly held with an iron fist under the Saddam regime, and the Shiites who currently rule the country with a tinfoil hand. More corrupt and pretty biased. In the light of a video showing mass executions of soldiers and civilians, the world finds itself again in the awkward situation of decrying the violence while sitting back and doing nothing. The dilemma is even worse for the U.S., who has had calls for direct military intervention from the Iraqi government. It has come to the point where the U.S. have had on and off talks with Iran, yes, axes of evil Iran, about what can be done to help settle things in Iraq. Now on the show many times before, I have said that the world, via the UN, has a right to protect innocent civilians who are being targeted by their own government. I would, in this case, extend that to anyone who causes violence against a passive population, as seems to be the case in Iraq. One could argue this was not the case in Syria, just to sort of provide a bit of contrast, where you actually had a popular uprising. Although civilians always seem to face the brunt of the violence, I would argue that this may be another case where we might support military intervention in the name of peacekeeping. Well, maybe peacemaking is a better term considering the recent history in Iraq. Now, some will argue that we should not interfere in the internal affairs of a nation. What right do we, however we define the we, what right do we have to pick the winner or loser? Because, or so the argument goes, whatever side you help, the rebels against the Assad government or Maliki government against the rebels in Iraq, you're thwarting self-determination. I would reject the idea that we would have to pick a side. The whole premise of peacekeeping is to stand between belligerents in an impartial way. The sides can still promote their positions, but they no longer have the avenue of violence to force the nation to their side. I would also argue that there are times that, even if you upset a balance, that may be preferable to allowing the slaughter of hundreds to thousands of civilians. So let's return to Iraq. We should take a moment and provide a bit of history to the current situation. Many have argued that Iraq is a made-up nation, that unlike Egypt, Iran, etc., there are no Iraqi people. Iraq, under Muslim rule, i.e. Ottomans and Mamluks, divided the nation into three parts, which coincides with what has been referred to as Kurdistan in the north, Shiistan in the south, and Sunnistan in the middle, but always ruled by a central power, be it in Baghdad under the Mamluks or Istanbul under the Ottomans. After World War I, the land became part of the British Protectorate. This is when oil exploitation by the West really got started. The Kingdom of Iraq was created when the British installed Amir Fazl as king in 1932. Side note, Fazl apparently can thank T.C. Lawrence, i.e. Lawrence of Arabia, for getting the gig. Although semi-autonomous, it was very much under the thumb of the UK and later the US. In 1945, a strong Kurdish revolt started. At about the same time, Iraq joined the UN. Thanks to growing economic instability, wars with Israel, British protectionism in Kuwait, increased reliance on oppression to maintain control, and the rise of Nasser in Egypt and the Pan-Arab movement, the army overthrew the monarchy in 1958. There was much political turmoil in Iraq during the 60s, and it was only after the consolidation of the Ba'ath Party that Iraq achieved a kind of golden age in the 70s. In 1979, Saddam was chosen as successor to the retiring president. He actually set up the first parliament in Iraq since the fall of the monarchy in 58. He is also credited with much of the modernization of Iraq during the 70s. Alas, Iraq never had a solid southern border. Under the Ottomans, all of Kuwait and parts of northern Iran were part of the southern Iraqi province of Basra. Many times since independence, Iraq has claimed Kuwait and has had skirmishes with Iran on territorial disputes. Border tension eventually led Iraq to all-out war with Iran in 1980, with the support of the U.S. and its blessings. Then, the 1990 annexation of Kuwait happened, in spite of U.S. opposition, which led to the first Gulf War. Then, after a decade of sanctions and the ruin of Iraq, Bush Jr. thought about time to eliminate Saddam, and we get Gulf War II. Having completely destroyed the nation, removed the entire pre-existing governmental system, Iraq fell into a quasi-civil war, which was only suppressed with heavy U.S. military support. Once the U.S. withdrawed all but a token military force at the end of 2010, after 36 months of apparent recovery to normal nationhood, well, it seems we're back to civil war. I mentioned that there are three broadly speaking groups involved. The war is really between the Sunni and the Shiites. The Kurds in the north have enjoyed semi-autonomy since the Kurdish-Iraq War of 1972, with a lot of ups and downs, but currently they are the only force that can help stabilize the region. And because they have never had more independence than they have right now, they do kind of prefer the status quo, Shiite dominance, although they are no fans of either group. So back to the present. Should the U.S. step in and halt, if not reverse, the insurgency while simultaneously forcing the Iraqi government to play fair with its Sunni minority? Should they actually deliver what they promised prior to invasion, democracy and peace? Yes and no. It might be the right thing to do because of the UN Principle of Responsibility to Protect, which roughly states that if a nation's population are suffering war crimes, the international community has the right to intervene to halt these crimes. Now, I will concede that it's hard to know when an official war crime has been committed, but I think Iraq, and sadly many other regions in the world, think Congo, Burma, Sri Lanka, that intervention should have occurred to protect the people, victims who are not only citizens of the nation, but also citizens of the world. And to reiterate, this involvement should be of the peacekeeping kind, where troops remove violence as a means of political debate. Once again, back to Iraq. Beyond the responsibility to protect, the U.S. has a second moral obligation to assist, and that is Colin Powell's famous remarks prior to the U.S. invasion, the Pottery Barn Rule. If you break it, you own it. There's no doubt that the U.S. broke Iraq, and well, the tape they used to rebuild it seems to be failing. So because the U.S. has direct and indirect culpability for creating the conditions that have facilitated this crisis to arise, they should put troops on the ground. Beyond the fact that there is next to no support for this option, and the U.S. government has said that they do not want to be the Iraqi Air Force, they can't really do anything. The war in Iraq has been such a debacle that it is likely to overtake Vietnam as the worst war in U.S. history. And let us not forget the Coalition of the Willing. That's UK, Australia, South Korea, Italy, Poland. And these are only the countries that supplied more than 2,500 troops. Over 40 nations sent troops, including two from Iceland. Iceland? Thankfully, Canada was not part of this farce. When you couple this with NATO's over-response to Libya, where their duty to protect became regime change, and the under-response to Syria, well, adding to U.S. issues is its use of drones in nations such as Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and other places. Well, it's hard to think that any U.S. involvement would be unbiased. The foundation of many of the complaints about intervention revolve around the idea of its not peacekeeping but imperialism, which has been validated by the U.S. on many occasions. So my whine is not about the failure to help the people of Iraq or Syria or the Central African Republic, as sad as that may be. It is to weep that upon the arrival of a milestone of global humanity, the acknowledgement that citizens of the globe, regardless of nations, have a fundamental right to life, and it is the global village's responsibility to protect that right. In the long march of history, we are at last applying ethical rules on a global scale, as we've done economic rules for centuries. And I shed a tear of joy for that. And yet, having evolved to this point, we have executed this principle in such a poor manner that is likely to be relegated to the land of the theoretical, a right in name only. And for that, that is to weep for all humanity. We'll be right back after this break.
To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
It's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know, all the clothes. Let's say, you know, someone buys a clothing piece.
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture. And that's been around for centuries.
And we're back. Well, as many of my listeners already know, Discovery Channel's annual Shark Week has finally passed. Yet again, there was a pseudo-documentary about how a shark the size of a submarine, hint a mega great white shark, might be swimming off the shores of South Africa. It's not. I say pseudo-documentary because these shows have about as much truth as Spinal Tap, and it's willful ignorance on the part of the writers and producers and production staff, because when you remove all the reconstructions and what would it be like if, big emphasis on the if part, well, what real evidence are they presenting? What real science? None. Most of the shows come with a disclaimer about the myth du jour. Its existence is highly controversial. Events have been dramatized, but many believe it exists to this day. Well, some people still believe the world is flat. Some think ghosts are real. Some think trickle-down economics work. The fact that people may believe in it is a very low bar. So these shows are usually based upon some fringe science or something someone might have seen. They then spin this one piece of anecdotal evidence or some wild speculation into a one-hour mockumentary on the Discovery Channel. And there's a growing trend in science shows on TV, which started with the kind of documentaries that I grew up with. Not the most exciting, but very informative and educational. However, as the social contract with broadcasters to both inform and entertain viewers shifted away from the unprofitable inform parts to the very profitable entertain parts, so you saw documentaries evolve over time. You start with a lackluster but very informative show about, oh, I don't know, about how life can exist around thermal vents in the deepest part of the ocean. The show would have lots of images of the vent, its flora and fauna, a narrator describing the scene, how these animals lived, how the vents formed. But these had trouble competing with flashy shows like Big Brother. To compete for eyes, they evolved. So then you got the enthusiastic science shows, often fronted by some charismatic scientist like Neil deGrasse Tyson or Brian Cox. Not as informative, because some time is lost to the inclusion of splashy graphics and the awe parts. By awe parts, I mean something like this.
This is Victoria Falls in Zambia. This waterfall stretches for almost 2 kilometers. Making it the largest curtain of falling water in the world. But I'm not here to marvel at the scale of this wonder. I've come to see a much more delicate feature that appears above the water.
These magnificent rainbows are a permanent feature in the skies above Victoria Falls. Now, rainbows are a beautiful phenomena, but I think they're even more beautiful when you understand how they're made, because they are a visual representation of the fact that light is made up of, well, all the colours of the rainbow.
Rays of light from the sun bend as they enter the water droplets. The light beams then reflect off the back of the droplets and are bent for a second time as they leave. This bending and reflecting splits the light, and the colours hidden inside the white sunlight are revealed. But colour can tell us much more, because understanding the reddening of the galaxies has given us a profound insight into the nature of the universe.
What we see as different colours are actually different wavelengths of light. So blue light has a relatively short wavelength, and then you go through green and yellow all the way to the red end of the spectrum, which has a very large wavelength.
Starlight is made up of countless different wavelengths, all the colours of the rainbow.
By upgrading the narrator with a personality, someone who could translate the, quote, wonder of learning, you could gain a certain celebrity feel, always a popular hook, but it is still considered science. Then, because you can't always afford a big name, some science shows went for the reality TV show format. You know, where the show is ostensibly about, I don't know, let's say the discovery of a new type of star. But half of the show is about the scientists trekking up some steep mountain to get to the observatory. How they are crammed into a small room with 20 other people, all of whom are competing for telescope time. Then, of course, you have the obligatory big problem that may make their whole efforts nada for nothing. Like, oh no, there are clouds. Will it impede our observation to observe this phenomena? It might just mean their entire expedition is a waste of time. It's almost always a false crisis because they already know that they actually got to see the star in question because these shows have been recorded weeks earlier and it's already gone through production all long before being aired on TV. By adding these unnecessary, at least to the science of the show, faux crises, or even real crises, it adds to the suspense, moving away from documentary and further along to be works of drama. Anyway, these reality science shows spend little time on the science and more time on the scientist, which, if the documentary was not about the star, but instead what it's like to be an astronomer, I'd have no problem with it. But if I wanted sociology, I'd watch that channel and not the space channel, if you get my point. Moving further from science, you get the docudrama, where you basically take the reality show format and remove the reality, lighten up even more on the science, and put the fictional part front and center. So, based on some science, some historically accurate elements, but dressed up into a more entertaining narrative. Very entertaining, but not a substitute for real documentaries, especially when the amount of reality is so variable. But not all fictional accounts are bad. There are fantasy science, or in keeping with my nomenclature, phantomentaries. These, I confess, I really, really enjoy. These are your What Would Life on Another Planet Look Like? Again, science-based, but pure fiction. These shows make it clear that the subject matter is pure fiction, and what we're exploring is, given the science we currently understand, what could we speculate? The science is leading to speculation. For example, I like the Life on Other Worlds, which we know nothing about. Yet that said, knowing how life evolved on Earth, what can we speculate about life evolving on other planets? The biochemistry. The science is primary. The speculation is secondary, even if tarted up to make it more competitive with real fiction. One could argue something like Alien Planet is an example of this. But there's a line that the Discovery Channel crosses, where it shreds the line between fiction and reality. They take something like What Would Life Be Like on Another Planet, and then rebrand it. Have we found life on another planet? Are there extraterrestrial beings living in Yellowstone Park? Or let's take Megalodon, for example. A fantumentary title might have something, What If Extinct Animals Were Still Around? Or Living with Megalodon, What Would It Be Like? These are fantasy and speculations. But no, the Discovery Channel, it calls its pseudomentary Megalodon, the monster shark that lives. One could be excused if you might think Megalodon was really still around based on the title. And here's where the Discovery Channel has lowered itself to become the tabloid scientish channel. They take interviews with real scientists who are treating the subject matter as fantasy. But then Discovery Channel cuts these interviews in such a way as to remove sort of the speculative intent of the scientist. They manipulate them into sounding like they are supporting the pulled out of their arse show titles. So you'd get a real quote saying something like,
"Megalodon is a large predator. If we were alive today, it would likely try and feed on whales. We have fossil evidence of whale bones with megalodon bite marks. They definitely fed on whales in the past, so it's likely they would do so today."
Well, that becomes, in the Discovery Channel cut,
"Megalodon is a large predator. It would likely try and feed on whales. We have evidence of whale bones with megalodon bite marks. They definitely fed on whales."
The original is clearly fantasy. The latter blurs the issue, and on purpose. And thus we can turn to Shark of Darkness, Wrath of Submarine, which, according to Discovery Channel, is, and I quote,
"said to be the deadliest great white shark of all time. Submarine is a 30-foot great white shark that has terrorized the shores of South Africa for decades. Locals believe this shark is responsible for countless fatal attacks, but its existence has never been proven."
First, I should point out that a submarine is not 30 feet long, not even close. So even before the show begins, we have in our minds a submarine, like something you would see in a World War II movie. But those subs are like 200 or 300 feet long, 10 times longer than the 30-foot number used in a show. So we already have sensationalism in the title. It goes downhill from there. The premise of the show is actually an urban legend made up in the 70s by a journalist who wanted to see how gullible people were, and I guess how gullible TV channels masquerading as science news could be. There is no, none, nada evidence that this was true. A quick internet search shows that this has been exposed as a hoax from day one. But that assumes Discovery Channel producers were duped. But that explanation quickly vaporizes when you learn that the whole show was faked. That fuzzy film that purported to show what could be submarine was actually CGI. It wasn't even real. The people interviewed, the so-called experts, all actors. The events mentioned, such as submarine's attack on a whale-watching boat, never happened. There seems to be no more science in this show, in a whole host of pseudomentaries, than you'd find in some great cinema like Sharknado. Okay, that's one thing. You get the dumbing down of society, which sadly is not limited to Shark Week or the Discovery Channel. But there's some real damage done by Shark Week, the vilification of sharks. Sharks are on par with whales for being the aquatic megafauna least likely to be around the turn of the next century. Partly from overfishing for their fins, partly because they're bycatch. Bycatch is all that other fish that gets swept up when you get your sardines or cods, and they're usually just killed and thrown over the side. Of course, they also suffer from the fact that, as apex predators, the more fish we take from the ocean, the less there is for the sharks, lest the sharks starve to death. Sharks also suffer from a reproductive system that is, how shall we put it, slow and few, which in the long run seems to have worked well for them. But since the planet has been infected with the virus called man, well, not good news for the shark. Sharks are under extreme pressures that are pushing them to extinction. If we don't do something, as I said, most of them, the most iconic ones, like the great white, the hammerhead, the whale shark, are likely only to be found in aquariums and old videos. So back to my point. Shows like Sharkageddon, yes, that's one of the show titles. Well, people unjustly fear sharks and are less likely to support conservation efforts toward them. To put this into a more hyperbolic context, like the Discovery Channel, how many people would support the preservation and conservation of Ebola now? You might say, "Don, you said our fears are unjust. But hundreds of people are attacked each year by sharks. They are, after all, the killers of the ocean, no?" Well, the quick answer is yes and no. Yes, if you're a seal or the like. Sharks love the tasty, fat little tidbits. But no, for us humans. Because, well, to a shark, humans are bony wastes of time. To put this into a context even I can understand, when a shark bites a human, almost always by accident, it's expecting a turkey dinner, maybe a chicken. But what it gets is a crow, and a scrawny crow at that. The reason most attacks are on surfers is because from underneath, a swimming surfer with board looks a lot like one of those little fat-packed seals. So the shark is almost as surprised as you are when it takes a nibble. Now, there are some sharks that are territorial and maybe a little mean. They will bite not to eat you, but to basically say, "Hey, get the hell off. This is my turf." And it may surprise you that very few people have ever actually been eaten by sharks. Most people who die from shark attacks actually bleed to death from said nibble. Well, even if they don't take you as a meal, they still are sharks with big nasty teeth. Okay, now the obligatory. What should we really be afraid of? Well, to spoil my own list, the animal that kills the most people per year are not sharks, but people.
Wow!
I bet you're all surprised. But no? Okay, what if I told you the number two killer was mosquitoes? Which, to be fair, doesn't actually directly kill people, rarely. I've yet to hear of someone actually being drained of blood by these little suckers. Hey, that might actually be a good mockumentary for the Discovery Channel. No, but they do carry nasty diseases and parasites that are responsible for around 1 million deaths per year. The tsetse fly comes close with about 500,000. What? No one's surprised yet? Well, let's take a look at the top killer list again. Well, dogs rank high, about 30 to 168, depending on what list you're using. In fact, if you include rabies, that number jumps to thousands of deaths per year. Thanks, Fido. Of course, I grew up in the prairies, where there are a lot of horses and cows, which together, both of which kill almost 10 times more people each year than sharks do. That would be about 20 deaths a year in the U.S. attributed to cows and another 20 to horses. And the single biggest killer of people, the one animal sans human that will surprise you, and by single, I mean species, so yes, all snakes and all spiders kill more people, but only one species that kills the most people is, you know, I was genuinely surprised that this animal kills more people than lions, tigers, more than crocodiles, more than bears and bees, by an order of magnitude. Those others are responsible for tens of deaths. But the big winner on my list, take that as you will, is the hippopotamus, or specifically the hippopotamide amphibious, which accounts for almost 3,000 deaths per year. Now, of course, the real mystery is how they managed to accumulate such a death toll. Maybe there are a lot of people swimming with hippos. Maybe hippos are a lot more stealthier than you think. Maybe they're really fat little homicidal ninjas. Oh yes, and how do these stack up to real shark deaths? Well, about one person a year is killed in North America from a shark attack. About six die globally. In fact, in sci-fi's Sharknado, the original, the death toll was 16. So characters in the movie were many times more likely to die in the movie than real people that have been killed by sharks in the real world. And you are much, much, much more likely to die from watching either that movie or the pseudomentaries on the Discovery Channel. So I hope this will inspire you to donate to your favorite Save the Shark charity, never eat shark fin soup, and well, never turn your back on a hippo. They seem to have it out for us. We'll be right back after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Welcome back. Well, the Free Trade Agreement, also known as CAFTA, was signed into existence 25 years ago, and its offspring, NAFTA, turned 20 this year. These have been much-touted examples of the glories of free trade. Currently, there are negotiations underway to create a Pacific Ocean version of this called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. I thought, in the light of the TPP, it might be interesting to see what we have learned from NAFTA and the free trade experiment. Now, of course, it is hard to attribute praise or fault to any one trade agreement in a globalized market, but with that caveat being said, let's begin. To refresh memories, the first big free trade agreement was conveniently named the Free Trade Agreement. Not much hiding in that title. This was negotiated at the time between Mulroney in Canada and Reagan in the USA. Famously, there was a federal election in 1988 that was deemed a referendum on free trade. Sadly, even though the PCs lost seats and the anti-free trade liberals doubled theirs, it was, however, not enough and Mulroney won the election and free trade became a reality. So what is free trade in general? Really, the British were the first to support the idea of international free trade. In the 18th and 19th century, the British Empire was at its height. England was shopkeeper to the world, and they felt that if there was no barriers to trade, they could outcompete anyone and thus rule the world economically as well as militarily. Much of the early conflict between the US and Britain was over the idea of free trade. Britain loved it, while the not-yet-superpower US wanted to protect its own native industries from predatory competition from the likes of Britain. The free trade agreement signed between Canada and US had two really major points for our discussion. Trade disputes would be adjudicated by a binational panel, the rulings of this panel would be binding, and the tariffs and duties on a wide range of products would be eliminated. What was notable about CAFTA was the exemptions. East Coast fishing, magazine postage, and even beer productions were allowed to keep their pre-agreement regulations that favored Canada. And the Auto Pact, which has much favored Canada, was left intact. The US got some exemptions, but we're not Yankees, so let's move along. The results of this agreement saw Canada exports to the US rise from 25 to 40%. It also saw a dramatic increase in, quote, investments in Canadian resource sector. However, it was the value of the Canadian dollar that had the biggest influence on trade between nations during the 90s. This brings up the spawn of free trade, NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Agreement. Again, not the most inventive of names. NAFTA expanded free trade both geographically, it would include Mexico, but also sort of subjectively, that is, it would regulate more things. NAFTA started in 1992, again with Mulroney for Canada, Bush Sr. for the US, and Salinas for Mexico. Although by the time it was signed in 1994, the US was headed by Bill Clinton, and Canada had two seat changes, with a brief premiership of Kim Campbell and the long-term tenure of John Chrétien. This agreement impacted Mexico the most by eliminating all of its import-export barriers, as had already sort of taken place between Canada and the US with the initial free trade agreement. NAFTA was really a trade agreement between the US and Mexico with Canada tacked on as sort of an afterthought. In fact, there was actually no single NAFTA agreement for agriculture, but three separate bilateral agreements. It also addressed intellectual property rights. However, it did not address in any significant way immigration. NAFTA allowed for the free flow of capital, money, between nations while not allowing the people to do the same. Have you ever wondered why there are so many Americans trying to cross the border into the US? It's not because of Yankee hospitality. They're following the jobs. The Mexican economy did gain in some niche areas. Think strawberries, tomatoes. But their agricultural grain sector was decimated by subsidized crops and meats from the US via the American Farm Bill. Even in success areas like beer, the raw product that was used to brew was imported from the United States, and with, quote, foreign investment buying these companies, the profits were also exported along with the beer. Mexico went from a mostly self-sufficient company vis-a-vis food to a very dependent one, with over half of its food being imported, and items like wheat up to 70%. This makes Mexico very vulnerable to global fluctuations in food pricing. But again, we're talking about Canada. What has this trade deal done for us? Well, first, there's been a large amount of foreign investment coming into the country since the trade agreement. However, this investment has not been to launch new enterprises or develop unused resources, but has been used in the acquisition of Canada's economic crown jewels, INCO, Elcan, Stelco, Falconbridge, and let's not forget, the oil and gas industry is now largely in the hands of foreign companies. Of the 100 largest private companies in Canada, beginning with General Motors and ending with Rolls-Royce, 67 are foreign-owned. In 1997, there were 41 large Canadian petroleum companies. Today, there are only 6, and of the 35 that no longer exist, U.S. companies bought 21.
It's important to note that there's not really a single major industry in the United States that is majority foreign owned. We are a resource company, and yet the top 10 most valuable brands in Canada, 5 of them are banks, 2 are telecoms. There is Bombardier and Weston, the bread people, but only one energy company. Now, depending on what sources you use, you may get a different set of companies, but none of them will have many Canadian-owned resource companies on that list because they are an endangered species. And much of this investment is not at the net benefit of Canada. In a story we reported a while ago, Caterpillar bought Electromotives of London, Ontario, and then promptly shut it down and moved it south of the border to Indiana, a low-wage state. It's actually kind of a sad state of affairs that areas in the U.S. have replaced places like Bangladesh as destinations for cheap labor. Of all of the over $500 billion in foreign direct investment monitored by the Investment Review Division between 1985 till 2003, a startling 96.7% has been for takeovers of companies in Canada, and a pathetic, paltry 3.3% have been used for new business investments. As our economies become more entwined, so have other aspects. As part of the Americanization of Canada has included deregulation, privatization, and harmonization of our laws and practices with theirs. As more and more CEOs of, quote, Canadian companies are American or other foreign nationals, their concerns for Canada as a nation and people become secondary. Disinfluence has also occurred in cultural aspects. Yes, in some ways, Canada was a winner with the opening of Hollywood North, but the movies, the shows, the stories are not Canadian. The most popular shows on TV are not Canadian. The CBC has been gutted and laid withered. When I was growing up, there was a strong sense of identity, and not just hockey and Tim Hortons. It was The Nature of Things, The National, Canada AM, Nick and Jesse and the Beachcombers, and icons like Mr. Dress-Up. Now, I understand with 1,000 TV channels to choose from, there is no more one thing everyone is watching right now kind of moments like you had prior to the 90s. That said, those south of the border are still mostly watching American content. And so are we, watching American content. It's not ours. It does not reflect our unique identity. But let's get back to NAFTA 20. Now, some have pointed out that Canadian exports to the U.S. have increased under free trade, and it's true that in the 90s, our exports went from 15% to a peak of 34%. But since the turn of the millennium, that number has shrunken to 18%, about where we started. Our manufacturing sector has declined, and unlike our energy exports, which have skyrocketed, well, non-energy exports have cratered. There's been stagnation in wages. Unions have been cowed by the very real threat from management. Do what we say, or we'll pack up and move south. And while our exports are good overall, we still have a trade imbalance, i.e., as exports increased, imports increased more. Having already touched on the fact that foreign investment in Canada was really about foreign takeover Canadian companies, another effect is to concentrate industries into fewer and fewer competitors. The average firm size of the 60 largest corporations on the Toronto Stock Exchange, the TSX 60, compared to all the firms registered on the TSX, increased slightly from about 5 times to 6 times between 1950 and 1990. However, it has increased 23 times by 2010. While the TSX 60 companies' share of total revenue of all TSX companies has remained the same before and after NAFTA, hovering about 20%, their share of TSX company profits rose from 30 to 60% by 2010. Another as yet often skirted affect or effect of NAFTA is the surrendering of sovereignty from the national government to the trade panels. Ultimately, any trade dispute is not adjudicated in Parliament or the courts, but by a trade panel of lawyers, corporate lawyers. For example, when Canada tried to end the use of leaded gas in Canada because of lead's damaging effect on the brain, to the point where one researcher believes the drop in crime over the last 20 years is due to the elimination of leaded gas, when we tried to outlaw it in 1997, we, i.e. Canada, was sued by the Ethyl Corp of California. agreements that have made capital free while enslaving workers. And here we return to the other big issue with the TPP, is who is doing the negotiations. It seems it's not so much our politicians, but the multinational corporations who seem to have the pen in these negotiations. Now, there is a thing called overreach, and maybe we have an example. Not all politicians are subservient to their corporate masters as the American and Canadian ones seem to be. And it has been reported that the TPP is largely being pushed by the Yanks, but it seems some nations are putting their society before the economy, the people before profits. So there has been pushback by other nations. There's also been enough pushback by rogue politicians and the public at large to perhaps delay or even kill the TPP. It is remarkable the silence that the mainstream media has had on this issue. But the alternative media has definitely made up for it and has made itself be heard quite loudly. It does not hurt matters either that although multinational corporations like the TPP, not all businesses are multinational. Some actually depend on sort of a healthy society. They need people who can actually afford their goods. The U.S., as I said, is one of the ones pushing this agreement most, but may not actually pass it if it ever gets signed for one of the most laughable reasons possible, and that is Obama. The Republican Party in the U.S. so hate Obama that they will not let anything he's in favor of pass, especially a major history-making trade deal like this. So they have pretty much killed the idea of fast track. Fast track in the U.S. is where the president negotiates the deal, then presents it to the Senate for a sort of simple up-down vote. If it is not fast-tracked, then the Senate can add amendments, which, beyond the complications with four governments, will also likely include an amendment to repeal Obamacare. So, much like the League of Nations, where the U.S. took the lead but ultimately did not pass a treaty they themselves started, well, it's a sad day indeed, but perhaps with a good endnote. I guess I should wrap this up with bringing up the issue of giving up sovereignty to neutral panels, who will have the power to amend or rescind laws a duly elected government enacted. Australia right now is dealing with one of those panels where tobacco giant Philip Morris is suing Australia over freedom of speech because in an effort to discourage smoking, all branding has been removed from cigarettes in Australia. The mechanism for ultimately ruling who is right or wrong will be something called the Investor State Dispute Settlement, or ISDS. There is no appealing this group, beyond, of course, pulling out of the trade agreement altogether. The ISDS is, well, here's what George Mandelbrot, reporter for The Guardian, said. The TPP would allow a secretive panel of corporate lawyers to override the will of parliaments and destroy our legal protections. The rules are enforced by panels which have none of the safeguards we expect on our own courts. The hearings are held in secret. The judges are corporate lawyers, many of whom work for companies of the kind whose case they will be hearing. Citizens and communities affected by the decision have no legal standing. There is an innate conflict of interest when a lawyer judge may be in the past or possibly in the future employed by the litigants. It is epidemic in the States where the head of a regulatory agency will retire. They get hired by the same company they were charged for regulating. Then later on get rehired by the government to oversee your advice on regulations over the same companies they were just working for. So, it seems like a very bad idea for Canada. And fortunately, the Americans are so dysfunctional, it looks like the deal this time will be dead in the water. Until at least the next president. We'll be back after this break.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
Well, that's all we have this week. I'm going to end the show on a very inspirational song, poem, I'm not sure quite what to call it, but what it was inspiring. We're going to leave this show, the best of 2014, on that note. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
Like many,
I love to look at the stars. I love the fact that ours is just one among many. What I love about astronomy is that our constellations tell a story. Our constellations were born from mythology. Mythology was our first attempt to understand the world in which we live. We put a god in everything, and those gods would give us our reasons. Why is the sky blue? Who chose blue? The gods. How come men have nipples? It's the will of the gods. Why does this wine taste so good? There's a god in it. And for a while, there was not a single thing that the gods could not explain. We believed that their anger gave us lightning, their despair gave us rain. We whispered our desires to them, believing that their charity would sustain us. But those gods were just stories. But stories became a large part of how we learn. They burn lessons into our memory. They become a part of how we remember, and we can remember almost everything. Right down to that first unbearable bee sting. When we learn that this tiny blue marble we call the world has rules. Rule number one, don't fuck with the bees. An unforgettable lesson brought to you by your memories. I remember that I grew up loving mythology. I remember the story of the Titan Atlas, who was also the god of astronomy. The original global positioning system, sending sailors safely home by telling them which constellations to keep starboard. He taught us about the stars. He did all this while he held up ours. Our pale blue dot. But Atlas is caught between two different tellings of his story. In the first, he leads a rebellion against Olympus and is then sentenced to hold the heavens on his shoulders for eternity. In the second story, he is chosen to be the guardian of the pillars that hold up the earth and sky. I prefer the second story. It means that the world is not a punishment, but rather a responsibility. But how can just one be charged with such a burden? How can just one be responsible for all this? When I think of Atlas, I think of a single drop of rain. I think how unfair it would be to hold a single drop solely responsible for making the entire world clean again. I remember how my grandmother tried to explain our world to me. She told me a story. She said the ground and the sky, they love each other, but they don't have arms, so rain, that's just how they hold one another. I began to see how the earth and sky need each other, but I wondered about us. In this perfect design, where do we fit? Which piece of the puzzle are we? Like constellations, I began to see a connection between dots. I numbered my thoughts and drew lines from one to the next. I began to see us in the context of a bigger picture, sharpening the blur slowly into focus. We are Atlas. I saw that this pale blue dot, this one world, is all we get. There will be no reset button, no new operating system or downloadable upgrade. We will not be allowed to trade in our old world for a new one with climate control or better fuel efficiency. We get one shot at this. Dismiss all reports of second chances, we get one. And yet we draw advances on our future as if we won't one day be held accountable. We will. We are. The human race runs toward a finish line, emblazoned with the words too far, and wonders, will we ever cross it? Have we already? We are faced with a seemingly impossible task, and it's okay to be afraid. Our dilemma stands before us like a mountain carved into a blockade. The sheer magnitude of our problem would be enough to dissuade anyone. How do we save the world? We lay in our beds, curled into question marks, wondering, what can we do? Where do we start? Is hope a glue crazy enough to hold us together while we're falling apart? The burden seems immense, but we can do this. We must take the martial arts approach to loving our planet, love as self-defense. Forget about the cost. There will be no other thing as worth saving as this. Nothing more important, nothing as precious. This is home. All of our stories start and end here. We are sheltered within an atmosphere that has given us every breath we will ever take. Every monument we will ever make has come from the flesh of our planet. Water like blood, skin like soil, bone like granite. It is not a myth. There is no debate. Facts are in. Fact is, there's never been any question. We are facing crisis. We dismiss the truth not because we can't accept it, but because having to commit ourselves to change is a scary prospect